Hi, and welcome to episode 264 of the Untethered Podcast. Today we have Autumn Reed Henning, MSCCC SLP, COM IBCLC, rejoining us. Autumn graduated from the University of Kentucky with a master's degree in communication disorders. She's currently appointed in good standing as an assistant professor with a voluntary faculty series in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at the University of Kentucky College of Health Sciences. She was a founding board member for the International Consortium for Oral Inclofrenula Professionals, ICAP. Autumn specializes in orofacial function and development throughout the lifespan in her specialty private practice, Crystalis Orofacial, in Greenville, South Carolina. Autumn has been invited to speak for many prestigious conferences and organizations. She's written professional articles and has been featured on podcasts. She's also trained thousands of professionals from varying fields through her own continuing education courses. Her flagship course is TOTS Training. Autumn is married to Dr. Zach Henning, and they have a daughter, McKenna Henning. They reside in the Greer, South Carolina area with their beloved cats. Her hobbies include travel, reading, church, and any activity with her family. Quick disclaimer, all information, content, and material of this podcast are the opinions of the speakers and is for the informational purpose only and not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and or medical treatment of a qualified healthcare provider. Welcome to the Untethered Podcast. I am your host, Hallie Balkin. I'm a certified myofunctional therapist, feeding specialist, podcaster, business owner, and mentor. This podcast is all about getting your questions answered and collaborating with colleagues to bring you the most up-to-date information in the orofacial myofunctional therapy, airway, tethered oral tissue, and pediatric feeding therapy space. If you're new here, I challenge you to keep an open mind and join my mission to spread this message far and wide. If you've been around since June 2019, thanks for being a loyal listener. As we jump into today's episode, remember to listen with correct oral rest posture. Tongue up, lips closed, teeth apart, breathe through your nose. Let's get started. Calling all SLPs and OTs, if you are listening to this the week that it airs or the week of May 29th, come and join us at feedthepeds.com/training for a free training on how to screen your very first pediatric feeding patient. We are going to provide the cases and the screening packet. You just need to show up, join us, and by the end, you're going to learn how to understand who may need further assessment and possibly treatment in the pediatric feeding space. So again, if you're an SLP or OT, go to feedthepeds.com/training and join us for free. You'll get 5 hours on a certificate of completion at the end of the week. I'll see you there. Hello, Autumn. Welcome back to the podcast.
That's right. Thanks for having me. What is this, number three or number four? I don't even know.
I don't even know either. I feel like I'd have to actually go to the website and look.
You know, any excuse to talk to you.
I love it. I love it. And ditto. Yeah. And I know today we're going to be talking about a topic that you're super passionate about. And I think you even have a course that recently came out on this topic.
Yes.
Therapeutic readiness. So for those who may be new to even the term therapeutic readiness, maybe I'll turn it over to you and like, just tell us, like, what does therapeutic readiness mean to you? Like, what is the context around that term?
Yeah, great question. So in the myofunctional and feeding therapy and lactation space, there's, you know, traditionally there's been a lot of talk about, okay, after the procedure, what do you do after to rehabilitate per se? And initially there was not a lot of talk about what do you do beforehand? And a lot of therapists, I feel like, just kind of wash their hands. Well, there's a tongue tie, nothing I can do until after it's released. And I speak from experience. This is how I come up with courses and teach, is because of my experience. I can tell you, I've tried it both ways. I was that therapist that was like, well, there's a structural issue. Can't really do a whole lot until that's taken care of. And so, in recent years, more professionals out there have been talking about someone being ready for a release and things like that. But it's honestly been like no one's really had a bunch of like criteria or actual benchmarks. It hasn't been tangible. And so I looked back on like my social media and stuff, and I've been planning this course for literally like 2 to 3 years. And I just had to like nail it down and get it in my head you know, when you treat, some of it is like intuition and just knowing and, you know, just going with your gut but being able to teach, you really have to make it very clear, right? To talk about what you're trying to get across. And so therapeutic readiness is just kind of a term that I came up with of what do we want to achieve before a tongue tie release procedure? What factors are there that if we achieve beforehand, do we have better outcomes? You know, better quality of healing, faster treatment course, all of those things. And so that's in a nutshell what therapeutic readiness is. So yeah, we put it out there with specific criteria.
I love that. And I think that's so important because one of those big questions that we get so frequently is like, how do you know a patient is ready for a release? Or how do you know that they've hit a wall or they can't go any further? And I feel like you, I'm like, I feel like I always had this criteria in my head, or I had like a certain like knowing just from working with the patient that like, okay, this particular individual has gotten as far as they're going to get.
Right.
Now it is time for that next step if that's where we're headed, or if they're not interested in that release, we're kind of like, oh, we've taken you as far as we can go right now. Like, let's, you know, let's put this on hold and maybe we'll revisit this if X, Y, and Z happens down the line, like call us back kind of thing, you know? And so I think it's helpful to be able to put measurable, tangible, you know, guidelines, if you will, around something just to at least have that jumping off point for, especially for people who are newer to this conversation.
Right. And I also think it's a really good education tool for providers too, of like, hey, these are the things that need to happen before you ever, you know, release the tongue, or also for patients of, hey, these are the things we're going to be doing before embarking on this. And so that they know, especially patients that are like, hey, can we just do therapy? You know, we are going to do therapy, and this is like a check and balance as well, like meeting that therapeutic readiness. And then if we stop progressing, then we know, hey, we've tried therapy, we're as far as we're going to get, and that procedure is actually indicated. So I think it serves a few purposes. And, you know, a lot of the reason this course was so hard to get out there, because there's so much nuance to it. When is a baby ready for a release, right? There's so many timing factors, and you have to consider the family and, you know, the breast milk supply and all of those things. It's just a different ballgame. And the other, it was pretty easy for me to like really nail down like the older children and adults, but infants were tougher, and then toddlers and preschoolers, right, are pretty tough just because of the variety of how they present and, you know, the cognitive level and, you know, the fun, terrible twos, that sort of thing. So how, you know, they can't do full on myo. And so how do you get them ready in that oral motor feeding-ish therapy sort of way? And so that's what we aim to do. And yep.
Yeah. Has it been well received by the teams of professionals that you work with, or is it something that you really feel like you've kind of honed in on with them?
I would say it was a natural progression of with them. And like, as I was kind of developing this, essentially I noticed trends in patients and how they progressed and how they did after their procedure. And I would like communicate that to the release providers. And you know, over time, you know, we've developed that trust. And so our providers don't do releases unless we say, okay, this person is ready. We've just defined what ready means. And so, yeah, I think it's been good. I think it's been also really good for our therapist just to like have that, you know, and it's been a mental checklist for me, but actually having something that you can say, okay, we've done all the things that we can do. You know, this is really needed and necessary, that sort of thing. So yeah, in my community, it's been really well received. I've started writing it on my reports so that if a patient decides to go get their release tomorrow, at least my recommendation was not until they've been therapeutically ready. And that's written so that if they do go and have a release done by some provider out there, that if it doesn't go well, that's not what I recommended. So I think that's helpful as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also, it's not refreshing, but I'm trying to think of the word to hear that, like, there are still providers that, you know, exist around you that are not the perfect providers either, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people come to me all the time and they're like, hey, how do you get your providers to, you know, how do you get them on board? How do you get them to not release until you feel the patient is ready? And I'm like, well, it's not just me, right? There is like a team approach, and we've all kind of come to have a discussion together about like what that looks like from each of our perspectives. And that allows us to kind of come to the table and go like, okay, a patient is ready when X, Y, and Z happens, which sometimes may be different based on the patient, maybe different based on, you know, the patient's needs. It could be how dire is the situation? Do we have a kid who is headed towards a feeding tube, or do we have a kid where we have wiggle room and time to play around and we can kind of take a more leisurely approach in therapy? And, you know, it's like there's the perfect world and then there's reality, right? And so every case sometimes varies. And that's where I start to get these questions where, you know, like in my own course, right? You know, I'll get students asking me, well, like, how do you know when like this patient was ready versus that patient? And I'm like, this is that dance between art and science. That as you work with more patients and you start to understand different patients' needs and you really step into understanding who's sitting in front of you, plus you build out that team, you can have these discussions, right? With the parents of the patient, if we're talking about a pediatric case, with the patient, if it's an adult, with the other providers that are on the team, to really understand like what is best case scenario for this patient, and then what is reality if best case scenario it doesn't appear to be what's going to happen, right? So I, you know, I'm like, it's one of those things where I feel like that conversation comes up so much. And I know you've got providers you work really beautifully with, but I know that also not every provider is like our BFF or someone we work with commonly that may be on the same page as us. And that's also real life.
For sure. And you said a lot of points that I wanted to elaborate on. But, you know, I think as therapists, we want a guideline. We want to check the box. We want to almost like a lot of perfectionistic people in this field. It just is. And so I always say there's ideal and then there's real. And then I always say that protocols are based on probability. So protocols are not set in stone. You set things and you have like a general framework for what works for most patients and most people. But I think the mark of a great therapist is teasing out those individual needs and knowing when to like deviate from that. Either, you know, speed things up, slow it down, go a different direction, and have those conversations. So I do say that in the course, like, hey, this is a framework. This is not every patient has to do everything. You have to balance that with those other factors. So it is nice to have like food for thought and like a general trajectory and framework, but you have to still do your job as a therapist and weigh those individual situations and needs. And so I think that's somewhat of the challenge, especially with people newer to this space, in regards to tongue tie. They're like, well, what's a normal tongue look like? I'm like, well, it can look like a lot of stuff because it matters how it moves, right?
Yeah.
So just having, you know, they want like a slam dunk case and just very straightforward. And you're right. It's science, but it's also an art for sure.
Yeah. So like somebody coming in who maybe doesn't really know you yet, let's say they haven't taken TOTS training or your other courses, would you recommend that they take TOTS training first before they take a course like therapeutic readiness, or is it something that someone could jump into regardless of like?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it depends on where they are in their journey. Like if they're already treating patients affected by tongue ties, yes, touch training could definitely help. And I think there's a misnomer about touch training in that it's not just an informational tongue tie course, right? It's the overview and implementation of our model of care. So even professionals that have been doing this 20 years and been treating tongue ties and whatnot knows the ins and outs of them, it has challenged them and given them more information on a different way of doing things and a model of care, and, you know, has been valuable. I would say that, you know, you don't have to take touch training by any means to take the pre-release paradigm and the therapeutic readiness course. You know, you definitely just obviously need to be familiar with tongue tie and be seeing patients with it. Otherwise, it won't really make sense. So I would say not a brand newbie. Just understanding some of the foundational principles. But yeah, that's what I'd say.
That's helpful. Cause I know a lot of times I get those questions about some of my own courses too. And they're like, if I'm doing X, is this appropriate for me? I actually had somebody email me about like my Mayo course asking me if, it would be appropriate for them to take it. And they work with adult dysphagia. And these are like very, you know, cognitively impaired individuals who really don't sound appropriate for Mayo. Right. And I'm thinking like, where on my webpage does it appear that this course would be anything close to what you're looking for to help these patients? And I don't know if it's more of just like, I'm looking for something different. Could this apply kind of a question? Mm-hmm. And like, no, it really doesn't apply. You know, traditional Mayo is not for your aspirating dysphagia adult who is functioning at a, you know, and it was interesting too, because these are individuals who have been, you know, their lower cognition. And so they have struggled with feeding their entire lives. They're not new. They're not stroke patients, right? They're not even new to dysphagia. And I was like, no, this is definitely not what you want. At first I thought they were asking like, would feed the peds apply? Cause I was thinking like, oh, well, it depends where they are in their journey. It's not really appropriate either. Cause that's not what we're targeting, but like, tell me more about these patients and I'll tell you more if it might apply to them, but probably not. But like I saw Mayo and I was like, totally not where we're going here, you know? So it's helpful, I think, to know just like who this is for, what, you know, what background information you need to have. And so I think that's awesome. I have a question for you that actually came up for the first, I think it's like the first, maybe the second time this has ever been asked in my 40 plus years now of like teaching, and even talking about, you know, TOTS inside my course and the whole conversation around rubbing on an open wound following a tongue tie release when there are no sutures in place. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts or opinions on that? Or does your team have any, you know, protocol around rubbing or not rubbing on an open wound?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. I talk a lot about this in TOTS, and I think you took it like, 2018 or something. So it's changed a lot since then. But as my scope of practice as a speech pathologist, I don't feel like being in a wound is really in my scope. And
agreed.
Just opens us up to a little more liability than I am comfortable taking on. Secondly, you have to think about what's the point. Like, are you just doing it because the release provider recommends it? Or how does that help you actually functionally? And I don't really think it does. I think what happens is these releases are happening and then there's like reattachment. And so the provider's like, oh, let's really get in there and poke around so the reattachment doesn't happen. And I think there's a difference between managing the wound and over managing. And you know, you have to think about what the body wants to do. The body wants to protect. It wants to close any area that it feels vulnerable and open. And so rubbing an open wound just re-traumatizes it, adds to discomfort and inflammation. And then that wound wants to close and reattach even more. And so you're fighting, you're irritating it, fighting against, you know, swelling, inflammation, discomfort to try and keep that healing the right way. And so I've found less is more. And again, protocol is based on probability. There are times where we deviate from this. Now, we never rub the wound. We don't do that. But, you know, we will increase the frequency or add another little stretch in there or whatnot. But I find just manually lifting and passive range of motion really does it, because we just want to separate that tissue. And, you know, you don't have to do that 20 times to keep it. So, yeah. That's a touchy subject. And here's the thing that I would say too, is for us, our protocol, like when we have a new provider that wants to work with us with tongue ties, and, you know, or our patient wants to go to somebody, or, you know, they've referred us a patient or whatever, we have like a little survey that we give them. And on that survey is, you know, this is what we do for aftercare. Are you in agreement with that? Right. And so I definitely think these conversations need to happen so that, you know, the provider's not expecting you to do something you're not comfortable with. And, you know, they need to know what's going to happen after as well and come to an agreement of what works for both of you. So, yeah, it took a few years to get that all under wraps, but it works much smoother now that everyone can be singing the same song and not confuse patients.
I'm glad that we're on the same page there. And that's it. You know, I was basically having a very similar conversation with some of my students, and I was like, I really need to check in with Autumn. I'm just curious to know, like, if anything has changed, because who knows, you know, we always say, like, who knows 7 years from now, like, if we'll be doing the exact same things that we're teaching and doing today. But at the same time, like, that one, you know, that's one where I'm not sure that I would change, because like you said, to me, it just reintroduces more trauma, more inflammation. It's uncomfortable. And at the level that I like to caution, like, especially if you're doing feeding therapy, at the level that we're working inside of a patient's mouth, or that we want to be making progress with things happening inside the mouth, like acceptance of food, decreasing or avoiding food aversions, like other things that may be surrounding the therapy that we're providing, outside of that release, you know, rehabilitation and all that fun stuff, we have a relationship with that patient that we really need to consider. And if we're in there causing discomfort, do you think they're going to trust you to go anywhere near their mouth if you're doing that on a regular basis? And like, this is the place they come for you to go inside and stretch that out, you know? And it's, yeah, there may be some stretching going on. Like you said, we might be helping manage, but it's very different in my opinion, than directly touching the wound. And so I've always been a proponent for, like you said, like, I don't believe it's in our scope to manage a wound in that sense, like to touch the wound, to advise on medication surrounding the wound, like those kinds of things outside of the wound, surrounding the wound, like the tissue, like that is in our scope.
And the movement.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's, yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is just like, when that's open, there are things in there. There's muscle, there's nerves, there's vessels, right? And so I really don't want to go poking around in there. And then you also brought up research, and there is some new research on wound care for frenectomy, but it's really poor. There was one, I think it came out like maybe 2 years ago, and it talks about massaging the wound. So that's not even what we're doing. So it didn't really inform my practice or help me at all. I also think there's so much variability. Are we rolling? Are we rubbing? Are we massaging? Are we lifting? Are we pulling? Like, what are we doing?
Also, is it like a brand new wound, or has the tissue now healed and we're like a couple weeks or a month into it and it's not a completely open wound at this point? Like, yes, it's still healing. Yes, we still have layers of skin that need to, you know, grow over that wound over time. Because I know you teach in your course, it like takes like a full year for that site to really come back to where it was pre, you know, surgery. So there is a lot of healing to happen. And when you understand the body, like, that's a whole different conversation. Yep. But I'm like, are we talking about like a day old, 2 day old, a 7 day old wound? Are we talking about 14 days, 21 days, 30 days?
Very plus? Different. Yeah. And yeah. You know, I would look to, like, you know, once that outer layer is healed, sure, massage that tissue to keep those underlayers nice and supple and healing well, just like you would like, okay, a scar, like looking at that literature, you know, massage has been shown to help with that. But yeah, when it's open, no go.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we're on the same page there. So any other hot topics you want to talk about today?
Gosh, I feel like that's what we do. Yeah.
I know. I love it.
Anyone
love
listening, it. Listen to the lip taping one we did.
Yes.
That was good.
Yes. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And I still am like very much so like in the same world of beliefs around lip taping. I recently recorded one with MyoSpots. And, you know, they have like a tape that's like stretchier and breathable that you can actually like breathe through. And I was like, all right, like, but also he very much so, I think, is in agreement with like our stance as well. Right. And it's also funny because he's kind of like, I'm the worst salesperson, right? It's like, I sell this stuff and I'm telling you, like, don't put this on kids at night. And like, this is more like use it in therapy to do X. And, you know, if you choose to tape, then X, Y, Z. And I'm like, oh, thank you. This is so refreshing. Yes. Anyways. Anywho, I'm like, what other hot topic can we talk about, Autumn?
No kidding. Oh man.
Baby Mayo, you want to go there?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know,
I just got something in my inbox today because someone was like, oh, there's a CMT. They are trained with you and they're doing baby Mayo. And I like looked actually at this person. I'm like, no, that they're like, I think a certified massage therapist. So just like putting that out there that CMT also could mean that.
Yes.
But I'm like, look at what the letters mean when you see it after somebody's name, apparently. Mine does have a registered trademark after it that we're working on or that we do have in place. And we're working on it for the full written out thing. But I don't think certified massage therapists do. So if you see a little R after it, then you should be good to go. But yeah, let's talk about that baby Mayo stuff.
Yeah. You know, okay. I think that a lot of it is semantics. And I think it's marketing, right? Mm-hmm. Mayo is a hot topic, a hot term. Like, you know, you see all the trending stuff where teenagers in school are doing that instead of like answering questions because they're mewing. So yeah, Mayo is like really seeing its heyday right now. And definitely getting more in the mainstream media and things like that. So I think it's about marketing. And here's the thing with babies. Can you apply myofunctional principles? Sure. Of, you know, where the tongue should be resting, the lips should be closed. You know, that sort of stuff. You're not going to train a correct swallow. Because that A, they can't engage in that, and B, it's not even supposed to be there at that age. I do appreciate, like, you know, targeting that oral rest posture for infants, because that should already be there. But calling it Mayo, I think is misleading, especially when the public, it's hard for them to determine myofunctional, myofascial, you know, feeding therapy, oral motor therapy, like lactation, where are all these lines blurring? And so, yeah, you know, I talk about when someone asks for Mayo for their baby, you know, I talk about how, like, you know, a baby's job is feeding, and sure, there can be a myofunctional disorder, if you will, of, you know, incorrect rest posture or mouth breathing or whatever else. But I feel like an entire like thing on baby Mayo, that's not a field. That's not a modality per se. It's you integrate some oral rest posture strategies into your lactation or oral motor training or feeding therapy, right? So yeah, that's my take on it. Yeah, I definitely think it's super trending and clever to do that. But is it really representative? I don't think so.
Yeah. Right. And I think honestly, in some degree, it just causes, because it is semantics for us as professionals, right? But I think it causes so much confusion in the general public. And then it, you know, it starts to approach the topic of like misinformation spreading, and then who treats this and who do I go to for this, right? Because if you Google myofunctional therapy, you're going to get a whole, you're going to get a whole different boat of, you know, names, a whole different slew of names that can treat myo that cannot treat infants, right? And so I think that's where I'm seeing the biggest issue, because we get people calling all the time going like, oh, we're working with a myofunctional therapist and my child's 6 months old. And I'm going, wait, okay, tell me more. Like, what else do they do? Do they also do feeding? Do they do are they IBCLCs? Are they SLPs? Are they OTs? Are they what is their background? And that's where we started to get like infants coming from professionals who do not have the right licensure to provide this type of therapy. And that's where I become that big proponent and big loud mouth on like, this is feeding therapy with a twist of myo. Like you said, it's basically taking some of the goals of myo and adapting them to the work that we're already doing in feeding therapy. Because yes, we want the child to nasal breathe. Yes, we want the mouth closed. Yes, we want that tongue up at rest. Like we want that correct oral rest posture. At the same time, like you said, the swallow posture that we expect of an infant or toddler is completely different of what you expect of a child who's a little bit older and an adult, right? Like we don't even have the correct swallowing and chew postures until like after like 36 months of age that we then have as an adult. We don't rotary chew as an adult until hopefully close to 36 months of age. And I know the kids that a lot of us are seeing are far beyond that. That's why they're in our
practices.
Yep. Right. So, you know, to even apply myo to these kids at age 4 when they don't have these foundational skills for chewing and swallowing, in my opinion, is highly inappropriate, even if they're cognitively intact. Right. That should really be more of a feeding / myo approach, which requires a feeding therapist. So,
we do have, some toddler age patients that come to see us and say they don't have any particular like feeding disorder, but you know, they have open mouth posture, they're snoring or having some sleep issues, and we will work with them on some of that. But a lot of it is like education of like, okay, do some saline rinse, work on reminding them to close their mouth, do things like humming, because that requires nasal breathing, right? A big one is let's see the ENT to make sure that there's nothing structural happening. And, you know, you can have open mouth posture for a lot of reasons. But it's definitely not per se myo at that age. I do think that's misleading. And, you know, it's not going to result in change. If you're asking someone who is quite literally not capable of engaging in that type of therapy to do it, it's not going to pan out so well.
Yeah. And I think that's the frustration I hear from a lot of medical professionals in this space is the wasted time, the wasted energy, and the frustration of the patients or the parents of the patients by the time they do get to the right person. They're like, but we did X, Y, and Z, or we thought we were doing this and we're nowhere further than when we started, or maybe we made a little bit of improvement, but then we kind of hit a wall. Well, because the person that was seeing you wasn't really doing what your child needed, right? And then, and that's what's frustrating and unfortunate. And that's why I'm such a jerk about it and why I like to be so vocal. Because I'm like, at the end of the day, if it were me as that parent, I would be pissed.
Right. Yes, yes. And I've also seen a trend of like, people tacking on like a little class or not even a full like credential or certification so that they can see babies. And here's the thing, like they may understand like phrenectomy and tongue ties in older kids and adults, but it's a whole different ballgame with an infant. And here's the thing, if that's all you're trained in, what else are you missing, right? How are you going to, you know, work with a patient that's apraxic or has HIE or cerebral palsy or, you know, some of those things, or is potentially aspirating, you know? And so I think just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And many times it's not even a can do, it's a a no-no and shouldn't do. But, you know, that's where I, like you, have seen some train wrecks and some messes come through because they were seeing someone who didn't have that full adequate training or licensure or scope of practice or whatever. And, you know, it comes down to, you know, honestly doing to others as you would want done to you.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're going to put in the time to go get like trained or put money into certain courses, like just go enroll in grad school, go to school to become a speech pathologist or an OT, or, you know, like if you want to do feeding, like for your own good and for the good of your patients or the people you're working with, like, please get the right credentials. I mean, right. I know it really stinks to have to go back to school, but like,
yeah,
there are licensures in place for a reason. It's kind of, it's a law, it's a legal issue. You know,
I feel like very rarely in feeding is it one thing. It's like
for sure
GI issues and sensory stuff. And, yes. You know, like it's very rarely, this is just a tongue tie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's also where so many of us get so passionate about it, because we know, right, working with these patients that like there are literally so many pieces to the puzzle that, you know, we may have a podcast and we might talk about a case and where there was a tongue tie and that was causing a big issue for a patient. But like, we can't then take that and apply that to every single patient that walks through our doors. Like every single patient's different. And while tongue ties may be a big issue for a number of patients, like you said, it's not typically the only thing going on.
Yeah.
We also know that if you're not chewing and swallowing your food properly, you're going to probably have GI issues, which could be separate from other types of GI issues that exist, which could be different from lower airway versus upper airway issues. And if you're doing myo, you're only familiar with or dealing with upper airway. And how much are you even, you know, educated on those?
Right.
Are we considering lower airway? Are we considering the other types of things that happen once food leaves the mouth? No, probably not, because you aren't actually truly trained in dysphagia as it exists in the SLP world, for example, right? So anyways, I know we could go down a whole rabbit hole and talk about this all day long, but clearly it's one of those ongoing passion points of mine. but because at the end of the day, again, I just, you know, I'm like, I want to protect the patients, and it's not even about scope creep for me. I mean, yeah, that's like a little frustrating sometimes, but who are you hurting at the end of the day? And if you as a human being are okay with truly putting patients at risk, maybe you should check yourself. Like, why are you in the medical profession to begin with? I don't know. Just going to put that out there.
Yep. Yep.
I don't right sugarcoat things. You. I just kind of
tracking. I'm tracking.
Oh, good times. Good times. Okay. Any other hot topics we can talk about? Like, have we covered them all?
Let's talk about Inspire.
Okay.
Okay. So.
All right. Talk to me.
Yeah. For those people listening. So Inspire is a FDA approved treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. And what it is an implant. It sort of works like a pacemaker, but for breathing, for your airway. And it's a hypoglossal nerve stimulator. And so when a patient is obstructing and it senses that, it triggers an impulse to the hypoglossal nerve, which then triggers the genioglossus muscle. And the genioglossus is under the tongue, two big bellies of it, and it helps to move the tongue out of the airway. And so I don't know about you where you are in Florida, but here it is everywhere. I hear radio commercials, TV commercials. It's a lot of places, and a lot of the ENTs here are doing it. And I mean, hey, life-saving, helps people, good for you. But
it's FDA approved too, right? So that's probably like a big selling point for.
Yes, for sure. But you know, I think that.
Well, and a replacement too for like a CPAP, or is it being used with?
Okay. So I believe you have to fail CPAP, or not be able to tolerate it or wear it to qualify for this. But I think a lot that's not being talked about are the negative outcomes that have happened. I've had a few patients that, you know, their nerve is not working properly from it. Mm-hmm. And then also, So the genioglossus is the major airway dilator muscle. It is the most studied in both animal literature and human literature to keep your airway open. And I always say there's less invasive and less expensive ways to get the tongue out of the airway than undergoing an implant, right? And you have to have like the card for the airport. And, you know, it's, I want to say it's six figures for sure. And now I don't know how much insurance covers it, but
yeah,
I think
I'm reading here, like the, one of the downsides is cost of the device. The fact that it needs to be surgically implanted, but on the professionals.inspiresleep.com website, which I don't know if this is their website, they actually have adverse effects, including damage to blood vessels in the vicinity of implant, excessive bleeding, nerve trauma or damage, allergic and or rejection response to the implanted materials, infection, local irritation, seroma, hematoma, erosion, or swelling. I'm like, these, and there's more, but like these are some pretty big side effects.
Right. And I don't know, lately, I've seen people kind of thinking it's like the fix all. And here's the thing. If your tongue is thrusting at night, like what is that going to do to, you know, maybe you have dental work. What is that going to do to your teeth? Like, what does that do over long term? Does that make you more likely to be a tongue thruster? You probably already are, you know, if you have sleep apnea. But, you know, we don't know the long term effects. And just like anything, I mean, it's going to take a while for, you know, the science to catch up. But
they'd also, they list, this is their website, they list persistent pain, numbness, or inflammation at the implant site. So like basically chronic, tongue movement restrictions, irritation resulting from tongue abrasions on pre-existing sharp or broken teeth. So yes. I guess that could just be having.
Just because you're shoving your tongue out, it's making you shove your tongue out and now your tongue is scraped up. Yep.
Yeah. Tongue soreness and weakness, problems with swallowing or speaking. Again, there's more, but I just like a dry mouth, acute symptoms like headaches, coughing, choking, dysphagia, speech-related events like pneumothorax, like insomnia. I'm just over here reading these and I'm going like, so what are the positives? And there's a whole list of contraindications too. I'm like, they're really selling this here.
For sure. And, you know, I think it's like, okay, it keeps you alive. So yay. I think it's for people that decided that they just want to have a fix rather than do the work, you know?
But this is interesting, Autumn. Indications for Inspire therapy. Inspire therapy is indicated for patients with the following characteristics, and they have adults listed. Like you said, unable to use, you know, or get consistent benefit from CPAP, diagnosed with moderate to severe OSA with an AHI of 15 to 100, not significantly overweight. Their next section is pediatric patients with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Age 13 to 18 with diagnosed with severe OSA, 10 AHI, 10 to 50, unable to use or get consistent benefit from CPAP, not effectively treated by adenotonsillectomy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the direction they're going. They're trying to get it approved for pediatrics and not just those with, you know, those craniofacial features. Yeah.
Especially with all these side effects, to put that in a child so young, like I feel like we need to have eliminated so many other options before we move to implanting a permanent medical device that has such a restriction on tongue movement and such an impact on speech and swallowing.
Right. Especially with the Down syndrome population, you've already got those things, right?
Right.
Yeah, for sure. I have
so many questions.
there's much easier ways to get the tongue out of the airway, and less expensive and less invasive ways. And, you know, our best research on, you know, myofunctional therapy and sleep apnea says that we can reduce AHI by 50% in adults and 62% in kids. And so, you know, I'm a proponent of, hey, let's try that and then see where we are. Yes. You know, I also think, you know, as an adult, it's a lot to commit to because the structures are a little more in place. So, you know, you've got to have the septum repaired and surgical palate expansion, at least with like the TADs and stuff. And, Then the myofunctional therapy and potentially the tongue tie release. Like, it's a lot of things to commit to. And so I feel like this is, it's frustrating because you get a sleep study back and you see the recommendations. And the recommendations are lose weight, sleep on your side, CPAP or mandibular advancement device. And now Inspire is on that list, right? If you fail those, here's Inspire. Like, why is myofunctional therapy not on there? You know, as, and not saying it's a replacement or it can fix it all by any means, but we do know that the tongue, the palate, all of the pharyngeal walls, they're all muscles, right? And they're what keeps the airway open. And so why not? Why isn't it on there? Why isn't it being offered to patients?
Much cheaper option compared to this device.
For sure. For sure. So insurance. So that's what I'd love to change, you know, and start getting that on the recommendation list, because I feel like they're not, you know, and they, I'm meaning the whole system, right? No one's like doing this to be awful or anything, but I feel like it's something that should be offered. And it, we do have research to say that myofunctional therapy can help CPAP compliance. So, you know, if your tongue is low and you're just blowing air at that obstruction, it's not going to be very effective. It's not going to be comfortable. You're going to rip that mask off. And so if we can get your tongue in the right place, your CPAP can be way more effective. So I'm not proposing it, myofunctional therapy, to replace anything, but it definitely should be an adjunctive option and communicated to patients. So I hope we get there.
I 100% agree, especially with pediatrics. I mean, it would be nice to see that get there with adults too. But I mean, I just, like you said earlier, with the whole less is more, I feel like I find myself saying that a lot too. And what is the least invasive option? And how do we move from like where we are right now towards the end goal in the least invasive way? Like, that's like, why are we not operating from that place?
Right. And, you know, I think it's totally a balance of that, of like, yeah, like we want to be conservative and not just jump to doing all these procedures and expensive things. But we also want to weigh the risk of how quickly these treatments are going to work, especially with like sleep disordered breathing and the developing brain and stuff like that. So it you're right. Like, it's so individualized of what we need and when and how quickly. And, you know, you don't want to overkill it, but you also don't want to like take your sweet time. Yeah, it's definitely a balance.
Yeah. I would love to see like those beam reader reports that, you know, are coming with the CBCTs come back with recommendations for even, you know, myofunctional therapy, pediatric feeding therapy. You know, this child could really benefit from some sort of behavioral based, like, you know, when I say behavioral, I don't mean like,
yeah,
I know, ABA or like behavior in that context for those who are not familiar, but we call the work that we do in the medical space like a behavioral approach, right? It's not a surgical approach.
Yeah.
We're working to change habits, or we're working to change the function. Exactly. So it's more of a functional approach than like a surgical approach, if you will. So yeah, I would love to see that shift.
Yeah. I think mostly what's on there is there any pathology? There any mass in their sinus or something? There's
right,
not.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, you know, they'll sometimes comment on hypertrophied adenoids or tonsils or whatever, but it would be nice if they would comment on the actual airway space. And that's usually like the dentist doing like the measurements with the CBCT software. But yeah, anyway, the radiologist is like, man, don't care.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, that's like, okay, fine. Do we need to take it from the radiologist and then send it to somebody else for like the next level recommendations beyond the radiologist? Like, maybe it's not in their scope to make those recommendations. Fine.
Maybe. Who knows?
Who can? I don't know.
I know.
I don't know. I want to like go back and look at like when Ken, for example, right, like does a sleep study. Like, I want to go back and look at like what he put on mine, because I know there were certain recommendations that are far beyond what I got on like my own kids when it was just like a beam reader report or something. And I know he's doing a sleep study and theirs was not a home sleep test.
Yeah.
But I just felt like his were more comprehensive, if you will, and gave like differing options. It was just kind of refreshing to get a report like that from somebody that was not a myofunctional therapist or was not a feeding therapist yeah. that had suggestions that were like, oh, wow. I feel like this person, like,
that's the thing. Like Ken has learned about that stuff. And so he yeah. does have insight there and perspective there. And that's the thing. I think medicine is like these little boxes, you know, you're over here and this is what you do. And you don't know anything about that over there. And so, you know, a lot of it is awareness and education for sure. But how do you have someone seek that out? And I feel like those are the professionals that I want to see are the people that are looking for answers and looking outside their own discipline mm-hmm. to be able to refer patients and help them in that way or think of those alternatives. So
Yeah. I actually pulled up his report here and it even says like to follow up with referring provider for treatment/therapy if clinically indicated. And so I even just like that line because I feel like that then sends it back to the person who referred and is like, hey, here's what we've got going on. Like if you feel in your professional opinion that the therapy that you do is recommended, like this supports that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, yeah. I like how it's written out here.
And so and the other thing he too, but. Also does is he keeps autonomy with the provider. He's not saying you need this. He's letting right. them make that choice. So yay.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Good work, Ken, if you're listening to this. Thank you. We appreciate you. More of that, please.
That's right. Oh man.
Oh, amazing. Well, this has been amazing as always. Are there any like last things that we haven't discussed that you want
to? No, we just need to have more hot topics. I can't think of any more today.
I know. I don't know. The only other thing that's coming to my mind that I feel like, that came to my brain because one of my therapists just texted me and goes, I swear I just saw this kid in a stroller with their nanny going down the street and the kid's thumb is in their mouth. So they're still sucking their thumb. And the therapist is like, I was told the child was not thumb sucking anymore. We're not like seeing this kid anymore either.
Oh.
So the therapist on my team, like just like messaged me and was like, I'm like, yeah, well that checks. But the thumb sucking thing, that's been another one that I feel like has been coming up a lot. And I don't know why, but when I first started out in the myo space, it was my belief, my understanding, I was trained that you needed to remove all oral habits before engaging in a myofunctional therapy program. Like that was step one or myo would fail. Like that right. is
you
literally
can't,
what I
you're
was
not
taught.
A candidate if you don't get rid of
right.
it. Yeah.
Right. Like eliminate the thumb first. Okay. And look, can you do a thumb sucking elimination program in an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old, you know, who's like, you get them completely on board and they think it's their idea and they're like totally bought in. You can eliminate that. And like, then you're able to quickly move through a myo program because everything else, all your other ducks are in a row. Yeah, sure. That can work. However, in like 98% of other cases where that is not the scenario, what I found was I stopped taking that approach. I started doing like myo and or feeding therapy, depending on the child's age.
Yep.
And in many cases, they stopped sucking their thumb as they learned to get their tongue up into the roof of their mouth, up into their palate, simply because the tongue was doing its job and the thumb really had no purpose anymore.
Right.
Right? And obviously some kids are going to have that habitual thumb
hang
sucking.
On to it. Yeah.
Good. It's really hard to let go of. And there's adults who do it too. And so, yes, sometimes it is indicated. Sometimes you do still need like a more centered approach around removing that oral habit, but as part of your myo program, in my opinion, and not necessarily as a precursor to a myo program. And so for me, that's what I've been teaching. And I'll let you kind of chime in on your experience with this, but I think this keeps coming up. And so I was like, this is a really fun topic too.
Yeah. And I totally agree in that. You're right. Like the reason you have to eliminate the reason for it before trying to just take it away. Right. And so, you know, there's a bunch of reasons for it. The most common one or two common ones for me is airway issues. And they're basically stenting their airway open because it pulls that jaw and tongue forward.
Yep.
Especially if they're just doing it at night. And then the other one is that they don't have correct oral rest posture and typically tongue tie because they cannot reach the roof of their mouth. And so yes. when you go through like a checklist, you know, we were taught to like, how often, wonder what circumstances do they suck their thumb? Do you notice it's with certain emotions or whatever? 99% of the time it's when they're anxious or worried or in a new situation. And that's where they don't have the tongue to be able to stimulate those feel good, relaxing, happy neurotransmitters. And so when you start doing that and their tongue is up more often, now they don't need that. And we have had patients that have like just stopped on their own from doing myo. I think it also like, especially, you know, certain kids can understand that. Like if you explain it to them in their terms, or talk to them about like, what do you feel like when you suck your thumb? Like, and they'll tell you like, relaxed, calm, you know, whatever, whatever. And then if you explain it, like there's a little button in the roof of your mouth that helps you get calm. And you're using your thumb because your tongue isn't doing its job. And I think that just like seeing the little light bulb in their mind, because, you know, probably they may have been made fun of for it. They, you know, the parents are just like, just stop, or grandma, I'm going to put hot sauce on that thumb, or, you know, stuff like that. And they've been made to feel like it's their fault and it's something they can control and it's shameful. Same with bedwetting, right? Same situation. But yeah, I'm the same way. I integrate a thumb sucking program in per se program into, the myo. And so we don't really embark on that until we know they can get their tongue up there and we know their airway is clear.
Yes.
Just because you're just, it's not gonna take.
Yeah.
So yeah. And you know, it absolutely can just be a habit, but nine times out of 10, it's there for a purpose.
Yeah. And we get those parents who call and they're like, you know, do you do thumb sucking elimination programs? And we're like, we do myo.
Right.
we do myo. And
that is the elimination.
Right. I'm like, let's talk about what is needed in order to make this basically go away and stay away. And also let's make sure your child is ready for this. Cause like you said, it's not even just them being psychologically ready. Mm-hmm. We have to make sure they are physically ready on an airway standpoint. Like,
yes.
Is it fair to expect that they can nasal breathe right now? Can they actually nasal breathe? Like, I feel like that is the question that so many fail to ask. So thank you for bringing that up. Sure. Okay. Well, this has been amazing. I love that we always, you know, talk about some of the hot button topics.
We do.
I'm sure we'll do another one of these in, you know, so many months and talk about more hot button topics then.
Yes.
But thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Hallie. As always, I just adore you and thank you for all your work in the field.
And you as well. It's mutual. Where can they find you?
Oh, yeah. Mainly on Instagram. That's the easiest place to find me. Chrysalis Orofacial 1. I don't know why Instagram wouldn't let me have just Chrysalis Orofacial, but there you go. Yeah, we have all our links and DMs are open. So yeah, if you need any help with patient cases or more training on certain things, we're there.
Autumn is the place to go. All right. Well, thanks, Autumn. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Just a reminder, SLPs and OTs, students, CODAs, SLPAs, you all are welcome too. We have our free training happening April 29th to May 3rd, 2024. Come screen the peds to feed the peds, and you'll spend 5 days with me screening your very first pediatric feeding patient. If you're experienced, you can join us too. Everyone always says they learn so much, but when you join me, you're going to earn 5 hours for free on a certificate of completion. You're going to participate in the training, and yes, the recordings are available, but only for a short period of time, less than a week. So don't miss out. But you can participate live and learn how to use the screener checklist and the milestone chart. You will watch me screen my 2-year-old. And then we will screen my 4-year-old together. You're going to discover how to make sense of the screening results and make next step recommendations. And then you're going to learn the fastest way to launch yourself into treating pediatric feeding cases after the screening is complete. So go to www.feedthepeds.com/training, register for free, join me for free, and get those 5 hours for free. I cannot wait to see you there. It's going to be fun. Don't miss out.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you found value in this episode and want to hear more of these MyoTots airway and feeding related episodes, be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode on your social media platforms. You can access free resources and all I offer at HallieBalkan.com or pop over to @HallieBalkan on Instagram to get all the latest updates.